Hello and welcome to the CSW Podcasts. Today we're talking to Alice Hull, a professional writer with publications and sources ranging from the Chicago Sun-Times, the Columbus Monthly, Chicago Parent Magazine, Columbus Parent Magazine, and the Daily Southtown in Chicago. His range of experience gives Alice great insight into not only being a professional writer, but also collaborating with and editing other writers' work. Welcome, Alice.
Thanks, Doug.
What I thought we'd start off talking about today is, when did you decide that you wanted to be a writer?
I guess probably around fourth grade or so. I always liked the writing assignments we got in school and probably overdid them, putting, you know, decorative covers on my book reports and things like that. So it was not until high school that I figured out that writing books was not going to be very practical, that one would have to be independently wealthy to sit around and write a book for a year and then wait for it to get published. So that's when I turned my mind toward journalism, you know, semi-weekly basis.
You've written for several different publications. Can you talk a little bit about how the experience of writing for those publications differed, for example, in writing style or voice, things like that?
Writing for a newspaper is probably one of the more restrictive styles of writing. People expect to read things in a certain way in a newspaper, and even though newspapers are now trying to find out how to keep their readers by doing things in more imaginative ways, like three-part series that's written in more of the same style as you would read a fictional book, still most of the daily grind type of newspaper stories are written in what's called inverted pyramid style, which is most important thing at the top, and then gradually going down to things that you're just repeating that everyone should already know, but you need to mention just in case they don't. Magazines, they offer more freedom, but require you to be a little more mindful of the story structure just because of the length. A newspaper story, you really don't have to worry about structuring it. You just write what happened today, and then you fill in the reader on what may have happened in the past, and then by then you're pretty much out of space. With the magazine story, there's a lot more room, and usually it's not something that has just happened, because magazines take about a month to, well, a Time and Newsweek don't, but Columbus Monthly takes a few weeks to print, so anything we write about has not just happened. So you have to find a way to bring the reader in and make a point of alerting them to why, even though they've probably already heard of this story, you know, what does the magazine have to offer that's new and different that they didn't know already? And then, you know, find ways to work in all the really intense detail that is, of course, the joy of reading a magazine story. The richness of character that you can get into with describing people, and just really the depth of the storytelling that you can do in a magazine. And magazines offer a little more of the first-person essay opportunities. Certainly they're not wholly made up of that, but if you read parenting magazines, which I do as a mother of two, a lot of the stories start out with a little first-person anecdote and then go into the science or research behind why the story is coming up again in this issue. And with Columbus Monthly, in fact with the back page of many magazines, the last article or the last page is some sort of standing essay, and that's kind of a nice opportunity to be able to write in first person and give a sort of playful account of something that's happened to you, which I think is why maybe we all get into writing. You know, in sixth grade you always write about yourself and what happened to you, and then after a while, you realize you're never going to get to do that in the professional world, but magazines do offer that opportunity sometimes.
When you were talking about the Columbus Monthly, I was wondering about the time delays that you were on. Did you ever have a story that didn't get out there because it just ended up, well, 3 weeks later, nobody's going to be interested in this one? It died, or is that happen ahead of time with the editor said, no, don't do that story because in 3 weeks, nobody's going to care that, you know, this particular event has happened?
We try to catch that ahead of time. We try to only pursue a story that we know the word they use is advance the story. If we can't advance the story, if we can't add something, take the story to a new place that readers haven't been able to see before, then we're not going to just rehash it. There are many times when we get toward the second week of the month and everyone's frantically checking the dispatch to see what they're doing. As far as something getting completely jettisoned, nothing of mine was killed. Killed being the word we use to say your story and all the work you already put into it is not going to be published. Don't think any of my stories were killed while I was there, but everyone's familiar with the story of the young girl from Worthington who was out in the cemetery and was shot by the man who lived in the scary-looking house. And we were planning on going a little deeper with that story because we knew it had that quality about it that people would respond to, and certain stories people just can't get enough of, and it doesn't matter how many times and how many different publications write about it, people will just keep reading. And we knew that that was one of those stories, and we were sending someone to cover the trial. And, of course, on the second day, or the first day of the trial, the defendant decided to plead guilty, so there was no more trial, and there was no more font of information, knowledge, and people to interview. And simultaneously, we found out that the dispatch had spent the last 5 months intensely meeting with the family and being allowed into the girl's life and the family's life. And so after a little bit of resource investment of attending a few days of the trial and making some phone calls, the person who was working on that story just stopped working on that story.
Can you tell me about the difference between writing for a daily versus a monthly deadline?
That's a good question. Writing for the daily, the volume of material you produce is somewhat staggering. We would sometimes at the Daily Southtown write 2, 3, 4 stories in a day, and you would look your name up in the archive system and kind of, you know, see how many stories you've written in the last 3 months and sort of try to one-up each other. But in the newspaper world, you know, you get in the morning, find out what it is you're supposed to be doing that day. Sometimes catch up on email and phone calls, take a lunch break, and then frantically make phone calls until 5 o'clock when everyone leaves. And then when 5 o'clock hits and you've exhausted all your possible sources, then you write frantically until 6:30, file the story, someone reads it, comes to you with edits or questions, and then, you know, it's filed and it gets laid out. And the next day you start all over. The magazine was more challenging for time management because you have essentially 2 or 3 weeks to do the same thing that previously I had 1 day to do. It's tempting, of course. All writers, I think, are probably procrastinators. It's tempting to just not do anything for 2.5 weeks and then do what I normally would have done. But, of course, the idea of magazine is to probe deeper and get people to trust you and open up. So it's more fun because if someone, usually when you're interviewing someone, you talk to them and they give you, you know, 3 more ideas of, oh, well, if you really want to look into this, you should talk to this person, and this person. Well, in newspaper, you just sort of nod politely and say, oh, yes, that's nice, and maybe you write it down, but you know that you're not going to have time to call those people. And in magazine, even if they're on vacation that week, you might still be able to talk to them. So it's very freeing to have that amount of time. And then the editing process is much longer and more thorough. Magazines think of themselves as books. They actually talk about it using the term book. And that's because it's a more permanent piece of paper. The newspaper, we all know, is going to be used to line the birdcage tomorrow or wrap fish or pack your dishes up. So no one actually thinks, oh, someone's going to save this for 15 years and read it every day. But the magazine is it's just more permanent. It's glossy pages. It's a nice thick cover. Someone's going to throw it in their bathroom and maybe look at it 15 or 20 times before they throw it in the recycling. So it's much more important to not have any slightly wrong little break of the line with the print, or there can't be any mistakes in the magazine, basically. So the editing process is much more thorough and takes a lot longer, as long as 2 weeks sometimes.
Tell me, you were a volunteer tutor and a mentor for the cluster tutoring program on Chicago's West Side, which I imagine is very different than working on a newspaper or a magazine. I'm interested in if you could talk about how you tutored young kids on writing and how that changed your feelings about maybe writing and how it's developed and how you developed.
The tutoring program was a volunteer job that I did, and the most challenging part of it was actually getting away from work in time to make it to tutoring. Every Tuesday night was this horrible, stressful time at work as I tried to break out of work by 5 so that I could get through Chicago traffic to get to the tutoring program when it started. I had a young girl assigned to me in 7th grade, and I stayed with her until she graduated from high school, and she's now at Valparaiso University in Indiana. It was very rewarding to work with young people. They're so much less encumbered by what is expected of them, especially in writing. One of the problems with inverted pyramid style in newspapers or just journalism writing classes are that they teach you to write in this certain format, and this is what the reader expects, and this is what you shall produce. And, you know, children don't have, they're not beholden to that at all. They're so free. Their minds are just very creative, and they're funny. They're very funny. They're not afraid to be funny. I think we get scared of being funny as we get older because someone might not think it's funny, or we're just more self-conscious. And kids are not self-conscious. And I had a great time working with those students.
You also taught computer-assisted reporting at Columbia College. What is computer-assisted reporting, and what are some of its techniques?
Computer-assisted reporting is just a nice word that you can make an acronym, a nice set of words you can make an acronym out of, CAR, which is a shorthand for using the computer when you're researching for a story. Of course, everyone uses a computer to research for a story now. It's kind of an outdated term, I guess, but the point of the class was really to teach the students that, you know, opening up Google and typing a phrase in is not going to be the beginning and end of your research for a story. It was teaching the students how do you determine what websites are reputable, and then how do you find information quickly? And as we move deeper into the topic, then how do you find actual raw data? How do you find real spreadsheets of numbers that prove your point, and then how do you move those into a database of your own, and how do you manipulate the statistics, and how do you take, you know, the number of people shot during deer hunting season in Indiana and create percentages and all sorts of useful things, so that when you're going to write your story and you want to say how much it increased this year over last year, you just have a whole chart that already has that information in it.
Were there reporter-only kind of sources that you referred to when you were doing things like this, that you introduced people to that might be useful at other places? I'm just curious if there's like an AP computer system that reporters use.
Surprisingly, not really. It's really a matter of just learning what already exists. A lot of government sites are just full of information, and it's all public, and they already know that they have to be accountable to the public and show their information, so there's no battle to try to get the information out of them. There are other sites, for example, GuideStar.org, which is a site that compiles information on every nonprofit in the country. It keeps their tax forms, which is extremely valuable. There are some compilations of useful sites that are geared toward reporters. I think that PowerReporting.com still exists. Certain journalists have started up sites where they just list, you know, maybe by beat, like, here are some great court sites, here are some great law sites, here are some great health sites. But there's no secret club that journalists belong to that allow them to have access to certain information. In fact, the point of being a journalist is that, you know, we're not licensed, we don't have any special privileges, we're just representing John Q. Public, and we have the rights of John Q. Public, and when we assert those rights as a journalist, we're asserting them for everyone. So it's just a matter of using your time and resources wisely on the internet and not getting sidetracked by whatever Paris Hilton thing is flashing and bouncing up and down. But there are some, you know, I learned a lot from my students as well at Columbia. I was 28 when I taught the course, and I thought I was still pretty in tune with everything that was going on the internet. And it turned out that the best place to find someone's phone number, you know, when you're just searching for someone's phone number and you know vaguely where they live, ZabaSearch.com, which I had never heard of until my students pointed out that this is the best place to find phone numbers. And I thought, oh, well, great. And I've used it ever since. So it was not a one-way street in that class. We definitely learned from each other. But I was kind of surprised at some of the things the students didn't use regularly, partly, I think, because they have grown up with the internet, and therefore they've never gone through the tutorial on how to use Internet Explorer, or they've never looked at what else is on the Google homepage besides the toolbar you type in. For example, even searching Google News instead of just Google provides a lot more relevant results usually, because it's all from published reports, so you know they have some credibility, and they're not trying to advertise a product. And there are other ways, you know, you can restrict your search to only .gov sites, which are government sites, or you can search only images. Most people already know that. I did find that my students didn't often use the favorites or the bookmarks to save a page. They would go through all this work to find, like, just this perfect thing for their story. And then, you know, something would happen. Of course, the server would crash and all the computers would, oh, I can't find the page again, you know, and they would have to embark on this 45-minute process again of how did I get there from here. And a lot of times you can't get there again when you're trying to go back, as everyone knows. And I was surprised that only about 10% of my students regularly used, you know, very basic features of web browsers, such as marking their page that they found as a bookmarked or favorite site. So it was an interesting experience for me teaching that class.
What Your website shows a heavy interest in online communications. What are your considerations when you're writing for and designing a website, for example, which, I take to be a very different genre than writing for a newspaper, writing for a magazine. If you're doing a website, you're doing it probably for a very specific audience, and those kind of considerations might have a lot of impact on what you do.
Yes, writing for the web is very challenging because you have infinite space, but on the other hand, you know that people don't scroll down. So even though you could write and write and write and write, you have to decide how you're going to put those on different pages, because someone might click on something to find out more about a topic, but they're not going to just scroll down and scroll down and read all these wonderful things you have to say. When I've been writing for the web for marketing type of jobs, the keywords are, well, in all web writing, really, the keywords are very important, and you find yourself trying to mask the fact that you just reused the full name of the person three times in two sentences. Or, well, in AP style in journalism, you know, there's certain abbreviations that are used for states and for a lot of things. But when you're writing for the web, you almost never would want to use an acronym, because you're wasting a chance to repeat the keyword. And the Google bots that go out and decide whether your page is very relevant to someone's search or just partly relevant, they base that on how much text there is that's on topic and how many times the words that are being searched for appear in your text. So rather than saying, you know, Dr. Joe Smith of San Francisco, California is opening a new, you know, surgery center near you, and then in the next sentence referring him only by last name and abbreviating the state, you would just keep using at least Dr. Smith, if not Dr. Joe Smith, and you would write out the name of the city and the state, and you would keep referring to the city and the state, because the problem with the internet is it's not local enough, and it's only now becoming better at knowing where you are. If you may notice when you type in something in Google, you'll find ads that are for things in Columbus, Ohio, if you're in Columbus, Ohio, and that's new. It didn't used to know where you were, so it's important to spell out whatever the local connection is in the page a lot. And that's something that is different from how you would write for a newspaper or magazine.
Do you have a strong preference on the web versus print media? Or do you have you'd really rather write for one than the other? Or is it just doing different things at different times?
Well, that's a great question, because there's a lot more employment opportunity on the web right now. Lots of people want you to write for the web, and then they want to pay you almost nothing for this privilege. And of course, everyone gets their information from the web, and readership of print materials is declining. But people still prefer the weight or the reputation of a known brand. I was at a luncheon the other day listening to Ben Marison of The Dispatch talking, and he was saying that people tell him all the time, oh, I don't get the paper anymore. I get all my news from the web. I don't really read The Dispatch. And he says, oh, well, by the way, where do you get your news on the web? Oh, dispatch.com. So people still are trusting the brand, and for that reason it's more desirable for me and for others to write for an actual paper or magazine that's known and trusted. And if your stuff is published on the web, then that's a side benefit. As far as writing for the web exclusively, it's hard to determine whether the people who are running the sites are reputable. A few of the assignments I've taken, I've never gotten paid for, or they try to talk you down to almost no money. They don't have as much of a respect for your credentials. Really, anyone who can write in passable English and use keywords a lot can get a job writing for the web, and it's frustrating, and it's very difficult to sort out the real publications, because there's so many upstarts, and they all sound legitimate and good, and then you find out, oh, this is, you know, just someone who's has no budget and is trying to get someone to write for free. And so it's harder to write for the web. It's harder to sort out what projects you should take on.
Have you had assignments that you turned down that you thought, oh, I just don't want to write this one for maybe a reason, like you had said, that you thought that you wouldn't get paid for it?
Yes, I recently turned down an $1,800 writing job, which was, I was looking forward to the money, and I was thinking, this is going to be a lot of work. The assignment was for a website, and the goal of the site was, if you have some sort of life change, for example, starting a new job or having a baby or getting divorced or any sort of life transition that's major, this site was supposed to help you through the first 30 days by providing articles and reference materials and then this daily email. So first of all, you had to write 30 emails, which is 30 articles, basically, which I thought was quite a bit of writing for the money. And then they sent me the contract, and the contract said all rights in perpetuity for your $1,800. Well, most writing assignments, you are selling first rights. You're giving them the exclusive right to publish it for the first time, and then if you find a place that will take reprints and pay you a third of the price for the reprint, like Reader's Digest or something like that, you're free to sell it to them. And it's your writing. This is what copyright is all about. If you write something, you own the rights to that. It's yours. You created it. And I called, or I emailed the person, and I said, you know, this is not acceptable. Is there another contract you can send me that specifies first rights only? And she said no, that that would not be possible because they wanted people to come to their site. And if I reprinted it elsewhere, why would anyone come to their site for it? Which sounded legitimate. So I said, okay, how about I give you a year of exclusive rights to this and then I take it back? Well, no, that was not acceptable. And the contract was so sort of suffocating that I felt that if I had wanted to write a book on this topic, after I had learned all this information from calling all these sources they gave me, I thought, well, I'm going to be a real expert on this. You know, maybe I could write a magazine article for a big magazine, or maybe I could write a book on this. It seemed like I wouldn't have the right to do that, that they wanted me to write up the interviews themselves, the questions and answers, and give it to them, and that was part of the work product, which I then would no longer own. And so I just said that I was not going to sign the contract and turned down the job. And that was the first time I'd ever done that. But I did it after going to a journalist's union website and looking up what should a contract say and what can I give away and what is too much. And the site indicated that largely because of the web, people are giving away more and more, and they're not getting reimbursed for having a newspaper story preprinted on the internet. You know, you'll write something for, say, Suburban News, and they'll put it on their website, and you only get paid for what was put in the paper, and you're not getting paid again when they essentially publish it a second time. And that this is getting out of hand, and we all need to stand up for our rights. And so that's really why I turned it down, was I felt that I'd be betraying my fellow writers if I caved into this. Full time at the magazine, I was doing the reporting on my employer's time. And anything that appears in the magazine is theirs, and I don't have any right to try to sell that for reprint or...
Right.
That work is actually not mine, because I'm employed by them, and that's a different type of contract. Mm-hmm. But for freelance work, you should be able to have your rights to your own work.
Yeah, it makes sense. What suggestions do you have for people that want to freelance? How did you get started getting assignments?
Well, the great thing about journalism is that it pays so little, you're almost forced to find freelance assignments from the first week that you start.
Yay!
It's great. Yeah. My very first job was at a little newspaper that came out twice a week covering the suburbs of Chicago. And it was terrible. I mean, and by terrible, I mean $16,000 a year. Terrible. Like, terrible, terrible. Fortunately for us, the publishing company also produces, you know, the Chamber of Commerce Guide and all these little custom publications that need to be fact-checked or have articles written for them. And it was easy for them to give us the work, and it was easy for us to take the work, because, of course, we would starve if we didn't. So that was my first foray into freelance writing, was these little community guides. And then I took a column at a paper in the suburb where I lived, which was... The papers were like the Northland News or the Booster, or, you know, the weekly paper, the weekly community paper, and there was just a column in there from a resident's point of view. And so I wrote that, which was just fun. It was a chance to do the essay style that you never get to do in newspaper. After a while, if you stay in journalism for more than 3 years, all the people you worked with have moved on somewhere else. And as your friends move on, they sometimes get editing jobs where they can pass out freelance assignments. And so this is really how I've gotten almost all my work. It's very hard to get work by sending query letters to magazines blindly, which is what a lot of books about freelancing will tell you to do. They'll spend endless chapters on how to write the perfect query and how you're going to come up with this great story idea and you're going to pitch it to you know, Self Magazine or Time or something, and they're going to call you and say, this is great, this is fantastic, we want you to write this big story for us and we'll pay you $1 a word. And it just doesn't happen like that. It's mostly the fact that you know someone who works there. And I freelanced for some trade magazines. My best clips are at Modern Healthcare Magazine, which is a national magazine read by healthcare executives, and it's boring for most people. It's it's about the business of running hospitals, and it's not exciting, but it's read by very powerful people, and it's a national magazine, and it's produced by Crane Publications, which is a very highly respected family-owned publishing house. And those particular clips I've gotten because I interned there as a college student doing survey work, not doing writing, and I just kept in touch. I would send them occasionally, you know, a note updating them as to what I was doing, or sometimes I would be competing with one of their writers on a story, or I would just send something to the office reminding them that I was there, which is technically what networking is. And I was able to get a few freelance jobs out of that. And when I moved back to Columbus from Chicago, I was able to call up a few publications and freelance for them. But by then, I already had a big portfolio of clips, and it wasn't like, who is this person who's calling, and I don't know what they want. And I still didn't pitch story ideas. I still took whatever they gave me. People wrongly think that magazines can't think up anything to put in their pages, or newspapers can't think up anything, and the opposite is true. They have all these ideas, and they don't have enough staff to write them. So it's much easier to find some way to ingratiate yourself as a good writer who will turn the story around quickly and not have mistakes in it and not require a lot of hand-holding, so that they will just give you the assignments they already have, rather than you putting all your effort into coming up with a great idea and finding all the sources and pitching it to them. And, you know, they don't have time for that. So that is pretty much the story of my freelance life. I have started this online portfolio, which is on my website, www.alicehole.com. And I started that when I moved here because I thought it would be a good way to showcase my clips. And it's gotten more and more professional looking as I've learned more and more web design and invested in software. And it's come to be a very valuable tool because a lot of the people who want to hire you for freelance work will say, we need someone to write this. If you're interested, please respond to this email. Do not attach any attachments or your email will be immediately deleted. Please copy 3 relevant clips of 5,000 words or more into the body of the email. Well, you know that no one is going to be able to get through a 2,000-word email. People are just not going to keep scrolling down in their Outlook program at this boring thing. And the only reason people can read a magazine story that long is you get to turn the page and look at a new picture, and there's headlines and drop caps, and you can't really expect someone to read along in plain text for that long. So I found it much easier to just say, please go to my website, here are links to specific stories. And I even scan in my magazine articles in PDF so they can see the pictures and the pages, and it just works out much better. It's a hassle, but it's been worth all the time I put into it.
Okay. That sounds great. If you were going to start over, what one or two things would you do differently and say to maybe students in a professional writing minor course, this is how I really suggest that you reform yourself maybe for the job market, as opposed to, I know that we were talking about suggestions for freelancing, but now I'm wondering to end, if there was something that you really wanted to say to somebody about, this is who I wish I were when I started.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I've actually been giving that a lot of thought because my alma mater, the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, is redoing its curriculum. And I've actually been emailing with the dean a bit because a lot of people are resistant to the direction he's going, which is more multimedia. And they feel that this is watering down the tenets of the journalism school, which are, you know, good writing and solid reporting and fact-checking, and you know, those are, that is the foundation, and those are the most important things. But the fact is, you don't get a chance again when you're 25 to learn how to produce for TV. Your chance was in college, and when I was there, you know, it was, the print people were, you know, print was serious journalism, and everything else was not. And, you know, therefore I had no desire to learn anything about radio engineering or TV, because these were not you know, this was not what I was going to be doing. I was going to make the big time, and I was going to be writing for the Washington Post or the New York Times, and I had no desire to learn any of these things. And, you know, of course, everyone doesn't end up at the New York Times. And another thing that happens in life often is when you're 20, you'll take a job anywhere. If that perfect writing job that's going to get you to the next step in your career is in Omaha, Nebraska, you move to Omaha, Nebraska, and you take that job. But when you're done being 20 and you're suddenly 30 and you don't want to move anymore because you've married or you have kids or you bought a house or you're just sick of moving around the country and you want to stay where your friends are, you find that the job market usually has one newspaper, three TV stations, a handful of radio stations, and, you know, maybe a few magazines here or there, maybe some weekly papers. And I found that my career options were really limited by the fact that I had never learned the first thing about radio or TV. And I see jobs out there, and I know I'm smart enough to do them, and I have the news experience, I have the news judgment, I know how to interview people. I know that I'd be good at that job, but I don't have the technical skills. And sure, it would probably take me 3 months to learn them, but employers now don't want to do that. They don't want to invest in a good person and teach them the skills, because they know that they can find someone who's both. They know they can find someone who already knows how to do it, and they don't have to spend time teaching them. So if I had it to do again, I would have taken radio classes and TV classes. We were forced to take a web class, thank goodness, and now I can code HTML by hand, which is still strangely useful. But I would have learned more about that, and I would have learned a little marketing, even though, you know, it's the dark side and it's bad and no serious journalist is going to learn marketing. But again, you know, you're not going to be 20 forever, and someday you'll want to make more than $16,000 a year, and the money's not in print journalism, for sure.
Alice, this is Darth Vader. Come over to the advertising side. I wish I could do a credible James Earl Jones, but that's sadly the best I can do. I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking to us and giving us the benefit of your experience. And I look forward to reading more bylines with your name on it and seeing your website, www.alicehohl.com, which we'll link to this podcast for all the people out there.
Great. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.